برنامه تاریخ شفاهی بنیاد مطالعات ایران، مصاحبه با آقای منصور فرهنگ، مصاحبه کننده مهناز افخمی، 21 اکتبر 1989 نیویورک.
But we are doing it in English.
English,
right? No, because you started talking Farsi.
I don't want to do it either, but I think we'd rather do it.
We should do it in English.
Let's start at the beginning.
Okay.
Where were you born, and when, if you don't mind?
Not at all. I was born in Sari in 1936. And when I was about 4 years old, not quite 4 years old, my parents moved to Tehran. Later I learned one reason my father decided to move from Sari to Tehran was that he had some difficulty with Afshar Tus, who was apparently in an official security police position, and he was involved in a kind of difficulty concerning an expectation of fundraising in the city that he was not able to do, and he felt threatened. Whether there was actual threat or not, I don't know, but he felt threatened enough to pick up his belongings and move. He was a businessman.
What kind of business was he?
He was basically, I would say, a tajir, a trader, who went through, up and down in his career. But fundamentally, he was buying and selling rice, sugar, for a while, dried fruit. Even some petroleum. Early in his career, they were buying a petroleum from the Russians when he was in Banda Pahlavi and Sari. So, and fundamentally, he stayed in the same business. There were times that he was very successful, and there were other times that he was down, depending on the kind of decisions he had made, and all that. But I would say overall, a rather middle class,
comfortable
middle class, more or less traditional home, but in a very peculiar way. He was born in Yazd. He left Yazd when he was 16 years old, and it was somewhat a pattern that in dry years, when there was not enough rainfall and the economy was bad in Yazd, young people used to leave. That's why we have Yazdis all over Iran. So he left during one of these periods. Nevertheless, he maintained his culture and his own orientation toward people and society, very much influenced by his own upbringing. And Yazd has a very conservative and well-knit culture. Then he married my mother in Sari, who was also there, according to a very idiosyncratic incident, in the sense that my mother's mother, my grandmother, was from Isfahan, Kazeruni. She was from the Kazeruni family. She married her cousin in Isfahan, and he was given a kind of official mission from Isfahan to Mazandaran. So after they got married and my grandmother was pregnant, they went to Mazandaran, but shortly after they arrived there, he was killed, again in disputes which related to the family, to business, and all that. He was killed. So my mother was born. She was the only child from my grandmother's first marriage, who was also very young, but nevertheless Isfahani. And again, the culture of Isfahan has its own distinctiveness, and so forth. So she was raised, in that family, and she remarried, had other children. And my mother, she was 12 years old, actually, when my father was 22, when they married. So he was a kind of a Yazdi, thrown into Mazandaran, and she was a child of really Isfahani background and orientation, thrown into Mazandaran again by accident of life. And later they moved to Tehran, So it was very peculiar. A lot of relatives and associations we had with people, they kind of represented a kind of mosaic of customs and habits, and yet we were raised, we grew up in Tehran, in the neighborhood and in the school and the friends and all that. So when I look back, it's very difficult to say exactly which cultural orientation has been more influential, because I know these things are very important in our country.
Did you have a large family?
Yes, there were. In fact, my mother gave birth to 11 children altogether. 4 died and 7 survived. My older brother is a physician who is practicing in Tehran. My younger brother has moved to the States. He's a very successful businessman in Tucson, Arizona. And my sisters, 2 of them are halfway between the United States and Iran, the family members here, and like many other Iranian parents, they're very divided in terms of their attachments and relatives and so between the States and Iran. And the other 2, more or less, they also have children and relatives here, but they're more attached to the Iranian scene. But nevertheless, they're all alive.
Did you think that you were growing up in a traditional family when you were growing up? Do you have a feeling that it was a...
It was a traditional family in form, in certain style. For example, my father was very much influenced by the social and educational reforms of the Reza Shah period, and he was a very socially active person, and he influenced my mother in the same direction. For many years, for example, my mother was a rather a-religious person, someone who had literally taught herself how to read and write, but I always thought of her as a very brilliant woman, who was very influential in our family. So this, there was the style or appearance of traditionalism somewhat, but there was no effort on the part of my parents to impose any kind of behavior or belief on their children. I remember some friends feeling compelled that they had to pray or fast before their parents, some. We were never really forced, not even suggesting. In many cases, my father wasn't even doing it himself. So it was a very typical, I would say, Iranian family of in the same family, some people playing poker and other people praying. And in the month of Ramadan, 2 members of the family fasting and others being very cynical about it. One praying regularly and someone else not even knowing the prayer. This type of coexistence seemed to be very normal, and no one really objected to the diversity of perspectives and lifestyles, but not only in my immediate family, but also my uncle and aunt and many others. It was the general, had a kind of loose and pluralistic kind of coexistence of various degrees of intensity toward religious or traditional values.
Your mother was veiled.
And then, it's interesting, when I was born, no. She was not, the generation that you know about. But later, as she grew older, that many in Iranian women, as you know, return to, in the beginning somewhat reluctantly or in a confused fashion, but gradually embraced it. But I would say she was in that sense quite typical, that as she grew older, because the early rejection of certain patterns of behavior was not a conscious choice. It was imposed, it was simply going along with what was happening at the time. Later on there was a void. In fact, toward the end of her life she became extremely religious. Extremely religious. She was studying Arabic. She was very concerned that the children did not seem to be pious and all that toward the end of her life. So there was this, to some extent probably, there was this change, yes.
And the sisters, how were they?
The sisters, it's very interesting. The oldest one, who was somewhat educated during the integration days, in the Reza Shah period, is fundamentally, constitutionally, temperamentally, I would say, a conservative person. And she's not an intense person either. So she is somewhat traditional, there are days that she could wear the veil and other days that she would not. But neither way seems to be particularly important to her. Just conforming to the occasion is very much compatible with her personality, My other sisters, though, they never wore the veil, and in fact, they objected to it. They resisted it, even if there was any social pressure. However, one of them, who is a year younger than I am, she married when she was very young, 17, and a modest middle class kind of, I would say, merchant class, bazaar-y kind of family relationship, and her husband was also working for a company which was located in Bazar. But after the marriage, they became extremely successful in business. That he was a very tough and shrewd businessman in land speculation and other, and construction particularly. He made a lot of money, and as he became rich, I would really categorized him as a typical newly rich unit of the rising bourgeoisie in Iran under the Shah. And it's fascinating, as they became more successful and more enriched by their business activities, they became more religious. That again, the void was particularly much. Here, for them, for example, someone like Shariati was an extremely important figure. They went to Husseiniya Irshad later years. And later on, I mean, she played a significant role in the sense of putting me in touch. I got to know Shariati through my sister, because my sister and her brother actually bought a house for Shariati. The residence Ali was living in was donated, as a gift given to him as a gift and all that. And my brother-in-law and sister were the principal fundraisers. And their relationship was so close that later on, Shariati sent his son, Ehsan, to Seattle, where they bought a house. And they also sent their own children. There are four daughters who are all graduates of University of Washington, totally different from the background of their parents. And there is a mountain of a valley of difference and gap between the social culture upbringing of the children, who were all really very Americanized, still they all live here, and the parents. So anyway, that's a different story. They got very politicized, and in the revolution they were very close to some prominent people, like all the crowd around Husseiniya Irshad, Talleghani and Bazargan and Minachi. They were very close family friends. That in fact, in the 1970s, when I used to go to Tehran, I got to know a number of these people, beside my own you know, political kind of connections, where there were new people that I did not know them personally, and there was probably no way for me to know them unless there was, you know, someone to introduce me to them, given the fact that I used to spend 2 weeks or 3 weeks in Tehran and also traveling. There was not enough time. So she has a difference, but she was the only one really political among my sisters or brothers, you know, for that matter.
So when you went from Sari to Tehran, do you have any recollections of Sari, your early childhood?
Yes, very vague. I mean, I went back, you know, several times. And I know, for example, but I don't know if, you know, returning to that neighborhood, or going to, you know, Meydan Saat, to what extent, I don't know, you know, but sorry. Anyway, I'm going back and I have a very vague record. I was not quite 4 yet. But what I remember very distinctly was when we came to, I still vividly remember the night we got off an old car, and we had to walk a long way, and my uncle, my mother's brother, Dai, he was carrying me from the Ray Street, you know, Pucha Upshore, where it was the station for buses and cars and Doroshkes and other stuff, to where they had bought a house, which was inside Bazar Chesed Ibrahim, which was a very traditional. In those days, it was the center of Ein Dole and the Ray, you know, these were the central parts of Tehran. Yeah, and then I grew up in that family and in that neighborhood until I was about 17, 18, when we moved to Amirabad.
And where did you go to
school? I went to, there was an elementary school near our house, Dabistan. The first year of in my elementary school, I went to Dabistan Mukhtalit. The first, it was at the end of that year, which the school closed and we were transferred to Dabistan Safavi. My oldest sister, who is 2 years older than I am, we went to the same school, and I have a lovely memory of that year because I. Bijan Mufid and I were together in that school and we were very close friends. And Bijan's aunt, Khale, was the principal of that, you know, school. And later on I even established contact. We had recollection of that year. But at the end it was closed. But I have very, very vivid, you know, memories of that first year of elementary school. And after that, Dabistan Safavi, which was within walking distance from our house. It was a rather rigid and not a pleasant learning environment at all, very rough.
And high school, where did you go?
And from there, high school, I went to Nasser Khosrow, again, high school, which was again near our house. Lots of friends were going. And then from there I transferred to another high school which was closer to our house in Iqbal. And then from there, during these days, I was becoming very somewhat interested in politics and society and all that, going beyond, you know, immediate family and neighborhood kind of interest. And then from there I transferred I was kicked out of one school for political activities immediately after the 1932 events. Then I went to Iran Shahr, and that's where I graduated. I completed my high school.
Do you have any friends from that time?
Yes, I do. I have many. Some of them are here, and when I used to go, even the last time I spent an extended period in Tehran, yes, I still have some friends. Some of them have moved to very prominent positions, you know, in the military, in the police force, in business, in the academy and all that. But I would say the successful ones from that period, from the Kucha Abshar Khiyabun Reneb, I would say a minority of students, no more than 10%. pursued education. The vast majority came from working class families, and they pretty much continued in the tradition of their parents. You see, the neighborhoods in those days were not at all as rigidly divided by class lines as they became in later years. I remember very distinctly, for example, that we had a house with 10 rooms. There was a mansion with a huge garden belonging to the Mahdavi family just about a block away. And across the street, there were houses in which each room belonged to a different family. So there was a policeman living here, a baker living there, a physician living there, a pharmacist living it. That neighborhood, it very much, in fact, under the pressure of change, you know, my father felt compelled, under immense insistence of my mother, to leave, because the social structure of the neighborhood went through this dramatic change, that all the people who could afford it, they moved away, and the family became more of the neighborhood became more of a, I would say, lower middle class, working class neighborhood.
During that time in high school, when you were becoming political, was that the time that the influence was mostly, you know, what, today, or what kind of influence? Mm-hmm.
No, there was no, I can trace it back, but not in any exact sense, that from the very beginning there was a very intense anti-Tudor, you know, sentiment. And it didn't really have much to do with the family, even though my father was very, you know, anti-communist and all that. It was politically conscious. First of all, my father was very much involved in the support in Bazar, in the support for nationalization of oil industry. So there was one source of influence. My brother was a student at medical school. He also played violin. So he used to go to these celebrations, and he was kind of recruited into the Iran party. Not because he was political, but because he was a violinist and a medical student. And this is really, you know, true. They needed him, and they used to compensate him by his way. Like, he managed to become an intern a year before his classmates in a semi-private hospital, that the insurance hospital of Bimaristan, Bime. And the only reason he was able to do that was because of political influence, that he had managed to please them with his violin playing in various occasions that they needed, you know, musicians and so on. So he was another source of influence. Some of his friends were active in the Iran party. I was involved in playing volleyball and ping pong, you know, being a champion and being on the school team. So in that sense, I also came to know in various ways that teachers, for example, the physical education teacher, but I remember Mr. Aghili, who was principal of Nasir Khosrow High School, who was a very intense nationalist and pro-Mossadeghist in the person. I would say a collectivity of this thing, not only a kind of pro-nationalist, pro-Mossadegh sentiment, but equally an anti-Tudeh.
More generalized thing, because the generation before had been apparently very influenced by the.
That's
Tudor.
Right. Definitely. I would say those who were about 10 to 15 years older, there was no other influence, in fact. In fact, it was during that open period in Iranian history, 1941 to 53, that there was a genuine marketplace of ideas and competition for influence and various ideological perspectives and so forth. This period, I would say, was not particularly helpful to the Tudor party. And also, at the time I was not aware or conscious, but later I could understand that the upsurge of anti-Tudeh, anti-communist, anti-Russian sentiment had to do with the occupation of Azerbaijan you know, that is 46, and all that. You know, I was, you know, 10 years old. So this is the period that you discussion in the neighborhood, in the school, in the family about occupation of Azerbaijan and Russians, and the fact that the Tudeh Party was supporting this the occupation and secession. So I would say a cluster of factors contributed to this atmosphere, that this was not particularly the period where Tudeh Party could recruit, except where the older brothers or the fathers had already been recruited from as members of the previous generation. So the younger brothers, which invariably followed, let's say if I used to look up to my, you know, brother, if he was a Tudeh, for example, it would not have been at all inconceivable that I could be very much influenced by it. But later on, when I got directly involved, it moved, you know, it became a different story, because I became very interested in Khalil Maliki. In fact, I became a member of the third, fourth party. And I was also interested in writing in these days. Wherever in Nasir Khosrow, in Iqbal, we had wallpapers. And I remember every time in any school I was a member of the group interested in producing a wallpaper, and always getting into conflict and difficulties with others over this. It was another avenue of interest in reading and all that. So I came gradually, I came to know his thinking when they split from the Tudeh Party. But that was the very early beginning of influence. I would say when Mossadegh was prime minister, actually, when I developed a more conscious kind of interest in organized student politics.
But prior to that, you weren't formally a member of
the... No, not at all. It just sympathies. You know, the involvement was such that if you were a curious kid, you could not remain aloof.
Okay. And did you take part in demonstrations? Do you remember any?
Bob, all demonstrations during the Mossadegh period, I never missed one. You know, including Siyatir, you know. But before, I don't really remember having participated in a demonstration in a serious way that I'm going to demonstration before Siyatir. We had demonstrations, for example, in Nasir Khosrow on various occasions that it had to do with all nationalization. Mossadegh's opposition to Razmara, his agitation in the school. There were always groups outside. They were not organized into a political party, but there was a network of informal connection in educational institutions as well as in bazaar and danishgah, including high schools, I would say, and invariably through teachers who had just graduated from the university, or some of them were still university students. So they were the agitators and all that. So the curious kids, those who have a natural propensity to pay attention to these things, which invariably are a minority of people. So these demonstrations took place, but I really have no conscious recollection that I felt intensely involved in defending a particular position, you know. But now, yes, we used to hear part because the people I admired were there, and so we had to be there.
And on CAT, did somebody tell you what was happening beforehand?
Somebody, you know, when Mossadegh was, when he was forced to resign and all that, in the neighborhood, there was activity, and at that time, still, you know, Malik Hizb Zahmat Kishan and Maliki, they were in the same, you know, group and all that. There were people in our neighborhood, including my brother and through Hizb Iran and all that, they were involved. So there was an atmosphere that I remember in the neighborhood, people wanted to go out and we must do something. So kind of joining the crowd and going with forming a group of 10 or 15, you know, students, largely from neighborhoods, the people who were both your friends at school and playmates in the neighborhood. Again, the people who were interested in these things, they were a minority, no question. But I remember distinctly that I made a conscious decision, we must do something, you know.
And you were on the street?
We were on the street, yes. We went to in front of Majlis. And we were actually witnessed, you know, running around and gunshots and tanks, you know, and so forth. And Amir Bijar, who was actually killed there, he was from our neighborhood. I did not know him personally, and he was somewhat older. But I knew later, I learned where he lived, like 10 blocks away and other. So there was a sense of pride that Amir Bijar was from this general area who sacrificed himself, you know, and all that. And all the mythology and fictions that one develops after these things. Yeah.
And do you recollect the actual event very well? What was happening? Was somebody giving a speech, or what was happening?
No, there was no, you know, in front of Majlis, the place where we went through Saçeşme and Majlis, there were groups of people congregating in a state of almost indecisiveness. They scream one slogan, you know, long live Mossadegh. And then the police, you know, I did not see any soldier anywhere on the way from a neighborhood in front of in Khiyabun Rey to Saçeşme and in front of Meçet Sepahsalar. But once we moved to Meydan Baharistan and that corner where the Hizb Zahmat Kashan was located, Khiyabun Ekbatan, that area I saw soldiers and tanks. But in there was a groups of 10, 15, 20, largely young, I would say high school, university students. And, you know, every time, obviously, in Tehran, in those days, you have half a dozen people pretending to agitate. There were people who could gather to see what is going on. So every small group, if it sustained itself for 10, 15 minutes in this part, could actually appear to be more impressive than what it actually, you know, was. I remember that very, very distinctly. So screaming your slogan and running away, we did that.
There weren't huge crowds.
No, the city was never not in the areas that I went in Meydan Baharistan, because there were so many streets, you know, people coming from Meydan Jale, from in Shabat, Mukhbar-ud-Dawla, but there was no huge congregation of demonstrators in any one place. Later on, I learned that the same kind of gatherings existed in Bazar and Buzar Jumhuriya and in front of the university in Shahrazad and so forth.
Were you at that time conscious of what it was that you wanted politically? Or?
To the extent that, you know, 16, 17-year-old kid could be, I would say by average standards, I was probably more aware of what was going on that people of my age group, because I was a voracious reader and really very curious about these things. Since childhood, I was extremely interested in going to school and becoming an ostad danishgah. Oh, I mean, it was my dream when I was 11, 12 and all that. I don't know where it came from. Through my father's relatives who were in education, and some of them I admired and all that. So one of them was a good poet, for example, Iyazdi. He was a teacher and a poet. Anyway, these influences were so, and yet if we want to go back and say, no, I really didn't know by any objective standard of what was, you know, happening, there was a raw feeling of sympathy and identity, the desire for group solidarity, an admiration and awe for the person of, you know, Mossadegh, kind of elevating him to almost the mythological, you know, level in our minds. And again, my father was also an admirer of Mossadegh, even though later on he became critical, but it was too late for him to influence me when he changed his position. So there was a great deal of influence. You see that if you had asked me in those days, if you would have asked a typical kid in those days, depending on her article, he would have said, Mossadegh is a patriot, mihan parasta. Mossadegh is pork, he's not a thief. You know, these are the standards of, yeah. He is well known, he is famous, you know, throughout the world. These qualities are nationalization of all that is the foreigners are exploiting or stealing our resources, and he's trying to save. These were, you know, the kind of slogans, I would say, that they had something to do with reality, but obviously did not constitute the entire picture. Yes, these impressions and these sentiments definitely existed.
Did it translate itself into anti-monarchy or a Republican?
No, absolutely not. I mean, the idea of republicanism did not even exist in a political discourse or in terms of our, you know, preferences or alternative thinking, not at all in the home, in the family, not even in the party later on, not at all.
And at what point did you decide to come outside to study?
Well, after the 53 coup, I became very intensely political, and here my brother completely withdrew. He didn't want to have anything to do with dangerous situation. My father became apolitical. Again, there was danger. And many of the kids I knew in the neighborhood, they also withdrew under pressure of parents and all that. And yet at that point, I would say, in my generation, I was probably the very tail end of the people who were politicized during Mossadegh. Period. We became very anti, kind of the idea of anti-regime or anti-Shah, not so much anti-monarchy again, anti-regime and anti-Shah feelings and sentiments and so forth were inculcated. They entered our political consciousness and sensibilities. And immediately after the coup, I wanted to pursue political activities. There was this urge, which had as much to do with what was going on as well as the, one's personality kind of structure. Because a lot of people with similar situations kind of withdrew. So I looked around to see who else. There were some people from Nirosevam in high school in the neighborhood, and these were really the only sources of contact. And high school was connected to Danishgah, usually through some students who had a brother there or a cousin or a family member, a neighborhood friend and all that. Anyway, we had connection. I remember Jafar Ghulizadeh, I remember he was, but I didn't know him. There were two or three people. I still remember distinctly their names and all that. So I had these connections. As time went on, like within 6 months, I realized that the core people who were involved in the establishment of the resistance, Behzat-e Muqavemat Milli, were a group of people who had split from the Iran Party, Mehmed Nakhshab, and his brother-in-law, who happened to be my teacher, my literature teacher, Enshad Dikteyna, that's it. Marjayi, Muhammad Nakhshab and Jafar Marjayi. He trusted me as a teacher, he got involved, we found that he was involved. So we had underground, a student newspaper was being printed, and I started writing for the student. So gradually, we developed a network of kind of semi-underground connection in relationship with Nehzat-e Muqavemat Milli. And most of the leaders of the Nehzat-e Muqavemat came from Jamiyat-e Azadi-e Iran, which was instituted by Nakhshab. The Iran Party became pretty aloof and apolitical. Most Nirusevam people, there were some. So We also had, during this period, there was a split within the Nehru Sevom Party between Khunji and Maliki. Maliki was in prison. Mm-hmm. He was sent to Falak ul Aflak. Khunji and Masood Ejazi, who became active in the National Front. So there was this split within the party. So we were very agitated as Nehru Sevomi members within the National Resistance Movement. We were divided. So there were fascinating meetings in various places, all underground and all that. I never forget that when Maliki, after about 10 months, the first time that I actually saw the man was when he was transferred from Falak ul Aflak to Tehran, and it was rather easy to go and visit him, and we went there with some other students. I visited him in prison, which was not really a prison, it was Farmund al-Nizami. There were huge rooms, and he was in a very comfortable room and all that, and Bakhtiar was still there, and Bakhtiar in fact used to like him. They used to have regular conversations about events. So there was this agitation, division, and I was involved in that. I was very much pro-Maliki and anti-Khunji. Why, I don't know. But at the time, Maliki seemed more interesting. So the arguments were advanced to support the sentiment. I would say the vast majority of kids my age were in the same kind of category. So we were involved on behalf of pro-Maliki Nehru Sevomi with other members of Nehdat Muqavamat, or the resistance. When Mossadegh was on trial, so these activities went on that I cannot really get into. Every day we had something to do, and I had become a very kind of a prominent member of this student underground, through school, neighborhood, and connection with some really big people like Nakhshab and Marjik, which was incidental simply because he was my teacher and he had trusted me because they were printing things in his house. So when Mossadegh was on trial, his defense was not published outside in its totality. So he had smuggled the defense out. So the National Resistance Movement had published a pamphlet. It was published and we were distributing. I was arrested with 150 copies of this pamphlet. And the only reason that I was given, so we were distributing it, and there was one man who worked as an engineer in telegraph building in Pupkhune, Mohandas Pakzad. I remember him very distinctly because I had to make sure that I wouldn't mention his name at the time. It was again a very crazy incident. So I went inside. I had been there before giving him out. We had a regular newspaper that I was a distributor and all that. But basically it was published by Nakhshab and Majid, the Nehzat Azadi people, but in the name of pro-Mossadegh coalition. So this time when I went in to deliver the in a booklet with his picture on the cover, he wasn't in his office, and I waited.
And you were just carrying all.
I was carrying this in a suitcase. There were 150 of them in a suitcase, and I was amateur. I waited in the hall, and he didn't show up. And finally, I was kind of panicky. After 20 minutes, half an hour, I decided to leave. As I was leaving the building, the policeman who was standing at the door, he turned to me and said, "What are you taking out?" Parenthetically, the only reason he stopped me because there was construction going on in the back of the building, and in previous days they had lost some wires and electrical related equipment, so they had been warned to make sure that nobody takes any construction or electric equipment things out of. Otherwise, and as soon as he said that, I panicked. I said, "I don't know." And he looked at me, so he stopped me, and I insisted that he stopped me exactly on the gate of the door, and he wasn't absolutely certain that there was, it was somewhat crowded. He wasn't absolutely certain that I was there, I was coming from inside and all that. So I detected shortly his indecisiveness. I made up a story that I was standing there waiting, you know, for somebody, which they knew it was a lie. But nevertheless, I suspended. I didn't want to say that I was going upstairs to see somebody. He would have been in trouble. So they took me to the security station inside the building. There was an officer and police. And so they got a knife and opened this thing, and they popped up. So from there, they sent me to, first of all, there was one colonel whose name was Shashani. He desperately tried. He, in fact, beat the hell out of me. Not so much. He was very interested in getting the information from me where I got these pamphlets, because he wanted to get the credit that he was the one who discovered them. And I resisted it. I pretty much, you know, managed to stick to a story. But he finally got tired, and he called Farhunda Nizami, and they came after me. So I went there, and I was there for a few days, and I repeated the same story. I had rehearsed it so much.
What did you say?
They even asked me to write. I said, there was one guy, I mean, all these things, there was one guy in our high school who was well known as an agent of, you know, Farhunda Nizami. His name was Rezvani, but it's an insane life, but Rasul Rezvani, 15 years later, parenthetically, I saw him on Hollywood Boulevard, and he was ready to kill me. I said, I got it from a hero. He left his school, and we hated him because he was always trying to cause, you know, mischief. He was with, there were a gang of people who always congregated near our school in Meydan Baharistan, Amir Mubur, in Rafizadeh, who was, they were gang type, who were also very rough. He was a younger member of the same gang.